Hello, and welcome to today's audio conference training offered by the Office on Violence Against Women in partnership with Praxis International. My name is Lucy Pope, and I'll be your host for today's call. Before we begin this training session, I'd like to go over a couple of details. First, this training is being recorded, and the audio recording will be available on the Praxis website at praxisinternational.org. In order to eliminate the background noise, all the lines will be muted throughout the call, so there's two ways that you can ask your questions. You can press the number 1 on your phone keypad, and the operator will get you in touch with us. Or you can email your question directly to Maren, that's M-A-R-E-N, at praxisinternational.org. So either way, we would love for you to ask whatever questions you need to. This session is Recommendations and Implementation. We have two very experienced trainers today, Jane Sadusky, who you all know, and Sue Parrott, who some of you might know from the different institutes at Praxis. So, Jane, would you go ahead and introduce yourself?
Thanks, Lucy, and hi, everyone. My name is Jane Sadusky. I'm over here in Madison, Wisconsin, and for about the past 12, I think going on 13 years, I've been a Praxis Technical Assistance Partner, primarily involved in defining and shaping what we've long called the safety and accountability audit, and we're now calling the institutional analysis, community assessment. We've got some interchangeable terms there, so it's good to have everyone on the line.
Thanks, Jane. And Sue Parrott from Washington, could you introduce yourself?
Sure. Hi, this is Sue Parrott. I'm in Bellingham, Washington, and I currently work with our local, it's a coordinating council. It's called the Bellingham-Whatcom County Commission Against Domestic Violence. And I've been with the commission for about 15 years, and during that time, we've done 4 safety audits. The first one was about 10 years ago, and Jane was actually she was my technical assistance person. I didn't do it on my own back then. That was way before we had all these tools available. Anyway, it's been a fascinating experience, and I'm happy to be on the call today with all of you.
That's great. Thanks, and welcome, Sue. So thank you all for joining us, and we're just going to get right into it and ask Jane to get us started here.
Thanks, Lucy, and I'm really happy to be on the call today with Sue. I was realizing, Sue, that 10 years ago, at about this time, we were planning that first endeavor together and figuring out how we were going to train the team and what we were going to do and how were we getting reports and would they even let us listen to calls and all of those things that go into the mix. So you're definitely one of the seasoned safety auditors out there. So we'll encourage everyone to take advantage of that expertise. I'm going to start with just a very quick overview of this method, and this is going to be very familiar to many of you. You've heard the spiel before, but we also know that we often end up with a different audience and people who aren't that familiar with what the institutional analysis approach to looking at our work is. So, and you can always go to the Praxis website, the three W's, praxisinternational.org, and you'll find lots of information if you go under our programs to institutional analysis and community assessment. So very briefly, it's really a way of looking at the work we do, and it's a way of analyzing practice in a community system or an institution, such as the criminal legal system, response to domestic violence, response to sexual assault, child welfare response to foster care and foster care practice. So it's a way of looking at work, and it's focused on how institutions are organized to meet people's needs and to find out how closely they're meeting people's needs or whether there's a gap between what people need, such as safety, and what institutions provide. One of the distinctive things is that it really avoids pointing fingers and blaming people, blaming individual practitioners. They don't get it. They don't know what the issue is. They don't care. They don't understand. But to really look at how the work is put together, how is it organized around concepts, around policies, around practices, around the way in which different workers and systems and people are linked together. So all of that goes into the mix. With this emphasis on working side by side as practitioners and systems, people who work in a particular system, whether it's child welfare or 911 or family court, working alongside community-based advocates and posing questions and exploring, again, how is our work put together so that we can accomplish certain things related to making it better for people, which is a very broad way of stating our purpose here. And we do this through a variety of methods. We kind of lay out how cases move through systems, mapping. We do interviews, both focus groups in the community and individual interviews. We look at a lot of case records and documents and policies, swirl that all around, and out come the recommendations and implementation that we're going to be talking about today. So you all should have received a handout packet ahead of time. And if you haven't, you can email Maren, M-A-R-E-N, at praxisinternational.org, and she'll make sure that you get a copy of it. It includes links and instructions on how to find the logistics guide that we have online, which has a lot of the mechanics of how to do this. And we're not going to review or refer to each one of these pieces in the handout in detail, but they are there to provide templates and outlines and examples of how you might structure a report, how you might organize some of the teamwork that goes into the analysis process, and an excerpt from a report that Sue has written that we're going to talk about in more detail. So that's all there for you to look at and use at a later point. We'll refer to a few of the pieces as we go along today, but as we're moving into the next part of our discussion, if you could, and you have things in front of you, turn to handout number 5, which is gap number 4 from Whatcom County's Safety and Accountability Audit that looked at protection orders. If you don't happen to have that handy, I think you'll still be able to kind of follow along a bit, but it will be very helpful if you do that, have that in front of you.
And the page number?
The page number would be page 13 of that rather hefty handout. So, okay. Well, as we were preparing for this, we actually ended up kind of turning things a little topsy-turvy and decided to start more with this example of a recommendation and talk a bit also about implementation. So Sue had suggested this gap number 4, and I'm just going to read it out here. Standard and consistent responses to reducing respondent access to firearms and dangerous weapons in the protection order process are lacking, despite petitioner safety concerns and practitioner knowledge of the dangers of domestic violence and firearms. And when she suggested that, I thought, oh, this is a really good one, because this is that tough issue that so many communities are facing right now. So we're going to start and have a conversation about how Whatcom County got to this recommendation and kind of where it's going along here. So I'm going to pose that question, Sue. Can you give us a snapshot of this safety audit and kind of how you got to start to shape up this gap number 4 related to firearms?
Sure. Just for quick background, the safety audit that this gap is from was a safety audit of our civil domestic violence order for protection process here in Whatcom County. And it was our first audit of a civil process. Previously, we'd been focused on the criminal justice system, and also our first audit of a court system, which presents some unique challenges. Two courts were involved. We looked at the process from the point at which a petitioner enters the process, either through the courts or a DV agency, through the court responding to the petition, either, you know, giving the temporary order, then the hearing, and then any changes in the order, to data entry in law enforcement in WASC NCIC, to service of the order. So that was the extent. We didn't look at enforcement of orders. So it was really kind of the application and the issuance and getting it into the law enforcement database.
And Sue, did you have some discussion that shaped, why did you stop at the process of getting the order and not go into the enforcement?
In our case, yeah, the reason we did, when we had audited our law enforcement response to domestic violence cases a number of years ago, and that did include looking at some issues of order enforcement. So I mean, it was somewhat arbitrary. Some of it was limiting the scope. So those, I think, were the two reasons that we had already done that, and we wanted to limit the scope. We really wanted to focus a bit more on the kind of the entry and the access process for petitioners. And the other thing about this audit, which I think relates a great deal to recommendations, it involves seven different agencies. So that is challenging, both in terms of organizing your team, the amount of information that you really have to gather, the data that you collect, and the level of understanding you have to have of the multiple systems. But it also relates to your recommendations because there is so much interconnectedness and interplay between these agencies that many of the recommendations do not stand alone. They do cross systems. So I had to really think about how do I structure my material in the report to account for these different agencies. And that could be a separate conversation. So I'll stop right there with the background. And then, Jane, you wanted me to talk about how we ended up with this particular gap?
Right. Yes, please.
Well, there's two. I would need to explain a bit of the process that we went through in the audit. Maybe I'll do it as an example. This particular gap, I think that when the team was doing their data collection, going out and, you know, interviewing, observing, reviewing case files, we noticed firearms in many areas. We noticed that there were questions about firearms in the petition that the petitioner filled out. We noticed that there were places on the court order where the court was to indicate whether or not firearms were present. We observed petitioners asking about firearms that their respondent had access to and whether or not the court was going to do anything about it. We heard advocates expressing concern that the courts were not responding to petitioner concerns about firearms. We heard from law enforcement that they were basically not doing anything about removing firearms when there were protection orders. We reviewed some of the laws around protection orders, state law, federal law. So through the identification of this issue, and we kept hearing from people about it, and I think many of the team members had information about the dangers of firearms in the hands of abusers. And then we saw all the ways in which this area of concern was not being addressed. And so this was actually a gap statement that came together fairly easily because the evidence and the findings were so specific to firearms. Some of the others, it was a little more challenging to craft the final gap statement. But this one came together easier because it was so focused.
So part of that process then was this noticing, oh, here's this reference, and somebody's talking here about firearms, and as that started coming forward, did you then kind of keep going a little deeper and saying, oh, let's go talk here and look here?
That's right. Yeah, like, well, what is really happening is there's, you know, what authority does a judge, what authority does a judicial officer have? So we would ask them about that. Then we said, well, gosh, have there been any situations where we found that there was a particular form that is available to a petitioner to request that that weapons be surrendered as a specific local court order? So we did a query. We asked the courts to do a query, and we found that in 3 years, only one petitioner had submitted the petition. So then we would ask advocates, are you aware that this form is available? And they told us no. So, yes, we just continue to dig deeper and deeper. Why is it that firearms are asked about and mentioned, but yet there doesn't seem to be really any kind of process in place to address the safety concern that petitioners had about their respondent access to firearms?
One of the things that really struck me, Sue, when I read this, and this I think connects with your what you're describing as, you know, part of this is really anchored in all of the work that you're doing along the way. So that if we look here on pages, for example, 14 and 15 and 16, where you're laying out, how do we know this? You see all these references very concretely to that kind of information gathering that you did. So looking at the law, looking at cases, going to forms, running a database query to see, well, what are the numbers related to how this request and this petition gets used, looking at the bench book guide for judges, observing the process of helping petitioners, lots and lots of interviews, it seemed, and looking at policy. So that really stood out for me, and it strikes me as an example of really then being able to describe this very concretely.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I think when, as the person who has ended up, you know, writing the audit report, even though the work is really the team's work, you know, and the team has decided that this is a gap that they've prioritized, they've identified the evidence, I feel very strongly that in an audit report or in your final report, you know, without that evidence, you really don't have a solid gap. And in fact, when we were working through all the information that the team had gathered, we had some areas, I call them themes sometimes before they become a gap, where we didn't have enough evidence. You know, maybe somebody found something and it concerned them, but we really didn't have enough examples to put it in the report.
And you talked a bit about your role and the team's role. Can you draw that out a bit in something like reaching this conclusion and writing this gap statement and actually bringing it all together? Your role and their role, and how those connect and might be different.
Right. You know, on each audit that I've done, this plays out a little bit differently, and I think it can really depend on your team members and the time they have and the skills they have, and you kind of learn who's responsible for doing what. But the way we did it was, as the coordinator, I was giving team members assignments. And as they did assignments, of course, they were asked to keep notes, which are incredibly important. And I would always request that they would give me a copy of their notes, so I would have all their notes. And we had organized my audit team into teams because they each focused on different systems. And so they would meet separately, and they were given a worksheet in which they would indicate a list of what they observed, examples and quotes are very important. And then they would also list what they needed to know more about, and then they might list what they were beginning to see as potential gaps. And what I would do was, over time, I would compile all the information from all my team members or their meetings into one document. So I would have this huge section of observations. So those would be quotes, those would be interviews, might be case file analysis. Then I would have a section of this is what we need to learn more about, and a section of, here's some themes kind of coming up, some issues coming up, which those eventually became my gap statements. Once we had a significant amount of material and I knew that it was time, at some point you have to say, we can't go anymore. We need to stop.
It's time to stop.
Right. Then I took it upon, in this case, what I was the person who took the material and tried to, and I did, organize it according to what I called kind of themes or possible gaps. And I created this document then that they all had an opportunity to look at. We voted on the themes or the gaps that they saw as most concerning and problematic. I think we had about 12 at that point. And then we just started working with those and really trying to flesh them out, agreeing, that everybody believes this is a concern, going over all of our evidence to make sure we had enough, defining why it was a problem for victims. Because if someone couldn't articulate that, then, that really wasn't going to go in the report. And then talking about solutions. So that was, I hope I explained that enough, but that was the process we used this time.
Well, here were a few of the things that I really noticed. You mentioned, are being able to say, well, how is this a problem? And I have to say, I really liked that box there that articulated so clearly that, well, part of this is that you have someone who's bringing up firearms in the way they've been threatened or harmed, and they expect that the system is going to understand
right.
that is dangerous
right.
and certain things will happen. And then also then kind of connecting it with some of what we know in the research related to lethality and firearms. And so you kind of drew a picture there that was both very local
right.
and also kind of anchored in this bigger understanding.
Yeah. And also from local as well as thinking about a victim too. It's like all those pieces became important. Yeah.
And one of the other go ahead, Sue.
Oh, this was just something I wanted to throw into in terms of our process. The I don't know how many of you might be close to are working on your report, but in my case, my final gap statement often is one of the last things that gets finished. Because as you're working with your material, you are always having to do, I found we had to do a lot of follow-up because you realize, I just don't know if I quite understand why this is happening. I need to call that, court administrator again and understand how it is that these decisions are made. And so the actual wording that you use in your gap statement, we started with something kind of broad. It was a concept that we all agreed on, but we didn't have the final wording till we had really finished fleshing it all out.
Oh, that seems like a really important point, that if you lock in and maybe a bit too early, you could get kind of sidetracked and you have to kind of come back and keep tailoring and refining what you want to say, right?
Right, because it should be reflecting what you found.
Now, a couple of other things I noticed here. Well, one thing was the way in which the problems and the issues are described, and the language is very respectful. It's not condemning. It's not identifying people by name and saying, well, you know, Judicial Officer Judy Smith does this or says this. So has that been important, do you feel, in relaying what a team has learned and then setting a stage for implementation and how things get said as well as what gets said?
Yes, I think, and it's something I know I'm very aware of when I'm writing, and I will admit that sometimes the conversations in the team meetings didn't reflect always that kind of respect to always be working on. But, you know, we had an interesting conversation in our team when we were working on the we were reviewing the final draft together and the way we worded our recommendations. And team members really wanted the wording should. You know, the audit team recommends that, you know, XYZ should. And I thought about that a long time and talked with some colleagues who were not on the audit team but are court administrators in some other courts. And because I was particularly concerned about the courts with this audit, and there are the importance of that openness and dialogue that we were having about their willingness to take a look at the recommendations. So I, that was an area where I told the team, that's one place I'm not going to support that. I'm not using the word should. I think there were places where I used it where I needed to because it made sense in writing it, but that was an example where I just thought, I don't think that will get us anywhere.
Yeah, that kind of absolute command sort of sense that a word like should carries. So there is, isn't there, kind of a lot of diplomacy and wordsmithing that comes into this process. And you might have a team that says, well, if we could just get rid of so-and-so,
exactly,
the problem would be solved. And in the end, not particularly effective. I'm going to check in and see if we have any questions, and then I want to come back and talk a bit about implementation related to this gap. But I think we should take a break and see if we have any questions on the line. So I'll turn to Lucy and Maren for that question.
Anything come through?
At this time, if you have a question, all you need to do is press the number 1 on your phone.
Or you can email Maren at Praxis International, and she'll be there to bring your question forward.
Realizing we have a topic here that probably could be a 3-part series, so we'll try to cover as much ground as we can.
Even if people just have comments that they want to make about crafting their own gap, crafting their own gap statements, what that experience was like, I think it's really helpful for others on the call who maybe are headed in that direction to hear from others who've been there. And I know there's several of you on the phone who are in the final stages of writing your report. So press the number 1 and share your experience.
Absolutely.
At this time, there's nobody in the queue.
Okay, thank you very much. We'll go along. We'll have a couple more spots where we will take a break and for questions and comments. So, Sue, you have a lot of recommendations here under GAP 4. What's it been like trying to implement any of them?
Well, this, maybe I picked this one because it was crafted in a way that made implementation a little bit, oh, I don't know if I would use the word easier, but doable. I don't know if people are looking at it right now, but one of the recommendations in the report, the first one was recommending that in Whatcom County we establish a work group. I called it the Domestic Violence Protection Order and Firearms Work Group. And the thought was this work group could kind of look at what was found in the audit and, you know, look at our authority, what authority the court has, what we could do different, and then develop some recommendations and then implement it. And then I went on to list some other very specific recommendations that related to, you know, the courts, to law enforcement, to advocates, that I knew potentially could be the kinds of things that might come up in a work group, but I wanted them in there in the event that maybe the work group didn't get formed or the work group might take a couple years to get off the ground. That would at least give, you know, each of those agencies some specific, oh, you know, this is something we could do. So actually what's happened is, and I think this has always been a question when you're doing an audit to ask at the beginning is, what's implementation going to look like and who's going to be responsible for it. And the Domestic Violence Commission has tended to take a lead in those recommendations in an audit report that require cross-systems collaboration, because I think what we found is that when a recommendation involves multiple agencies, which many of them do, it's not as likely that one of those agencies is just going to step forward and say, oh, gosh, I have so much extra time. I'm going to call this meeting of these five different agencies and facilitate these meetings over 6 months. So we did convene a work group. I'm still working on it right now. We're almost done with our recommendations. And having this audit report, having these specific recommendations were the foundation for the work group. We're actually ending up addressing many of the specific recommendations in this audit report in our work group recommendations. Some changed a little bit because I learned even more and found that, you know, what I had proposed or suggested maybe didn't quite fit. So it's still taking a while. And what's been interesting for me, even working in a multidisciplinary work group, is to see how those practitioners really have no idea what the other person does, and particularly the court is, I think, quite surprised how their actions impact others and how that dialogue is so important for there to be effective implementation of a new practice.
Which really, to me, speaks to one of the values of using this approach, where you're bringing people together and beginning to understand how it's connected and what everyone's doing along the line, even though they may have been in their roles and working in the same agencies for 10 years.
Yeah.
And maybe go out for a beer on Friday nights together, but really don't have an opportunity to step back and see how is my place connected with what you do.
Right.
And when you mentioned the role of the commission in implementation here, and kind of more at the front end, did you kind of expect that this was going to be something that the commission would get much more directly involved in implementing, given that there were so many systems involved?
You mean before?
Was that more,
before?
Or is that something it came later?
I'd say it came later, yeah. I didn't know. I don't know that I necessarily knew this was going to be one of our gaps or a place where we would be putting so much emphasis. So I would say in our case it came a little bit later. When we finished the report, what we did in the commission was I went through all the recommendations and pulled out the ones that, you know, involved cross systems or involved a kind of work that it seemed like, because we had the staff resources, we could do something. For example, one was putting together some kind of a universal packet handout for petitioners that all the agencies would be using around protection orders. So that seemed like something the commission could do, advocacy agencies could use it, the court could use it, law enforcement could use it. So we looked at everything in the report, and then as a commission, we kind of prioritized, well, what are the ones we want to work on?
One thing I should mention, too, is that after our call today, we'll be sending out the full report as an attachment to everyone. So if you want to take a closer look at it. You mentioned the work group that you set up, and it struck me that this gap in these, what, pages 13 to 18, so about five pages, really provides a kind of a work plan for that group. It gives them background. You know, lays out very clearly with examples, this is what we discovered and how we know it. And when you start reading the recommendations, you see that connection with those, what we've called the eight audit trails, or the eight ways in which systems organize the work that gets done. So there are recommendations related to training, to many related to changing administrative procedures, forms, how one point in the system is linked with another, changes in policy. So it struck me that really came through in a way that's very concrete about what needs to happen.
Yep. And, you know, the other thing, too, that in an audit process, we do the case processing, the laying out the, whatever you want to call it, a flow chart or the steps. So I created one of those for this work group as well. What I did was I created a process of a protection order, and then we identified all the gaps using kind of the audit report. Here's a place where, you know, there's this form that a petitioner could fill out, but no one's giving them the form. So then they could sort of see visually all those points at which we needed to think about action to address those gaps. So we literally used an audit tool, in a sense, in our work group.
Okay. Well, I'm going to shift us a bit here to something, because we've been throwing around these terms, findings and gaps, and I think this would be a good spot to kind of talk about what do we mean by that. And I'm curious, Sue, in all of the audits that you've done, have you found that explaining what a finding is and a gap has been something that you've had to step back and do and articulate with the team?
Yeah, I've been thinking about this. I guess so. The gap statement more so, explaining, you know, what that kind of really needs to represent. Probably spent more time on that. I'm thinking about that. I'd say I guess so.
Well, in our kind of our notes going back and forth, I think you'd made this observation this morning that we organize findings into gaps through analysis.
Yeah.
So we've been working on coming up with a definition, which I'm sure everyone out there would be thinking, well, it's about time you're throwing around these terms. What do you mean by them? So I'm going to throw out this term and then ask a question. And it seemed like in trying to really define it. What is a finding? Well, a finding is a discovery of something. So it's a conclusion that follows after a period of inquiry and examination. All of those interviews and observations and case file reading and looking at forms that you described. So it's not a gut sense or an opinion, but it's something that is grounded in a process of searching and inquiry. So it's grounded in that whole package of gathering information. But is it kind of tempting for a team to kind of just jump to solutions right away? To think, oh, well, I know that's a problem, in my opinion, of course. You know, I know in my gut that firearms aren't being taken away.
Right. Yeah, and this is what we need to do about them. You know, we just have to do X, Y, Z, and then we'll take care of the gap. Yes, the most common team members were quick to do kind of two things. One was often to jump to solutions, and they would just already start fixing it and saying, well, we just need to do this and this and this. And then I would stop and say, well, do you know? One example had to do with one of our courts was not providing any assistance to petitioners. They would come in, say, I need to file a protection order, and the clerk would say to them, there's information on the counter over there. And so the petitioner would have to walk over there, look at all these papers, and try and figure out, should they get a domestic violence protection order paperwork? Should they get an anti-harassment? Anyway, so, you know, the team was kind of saying, well, this is a problem, and, you know, they really just need to train their clerks to, you know, tell people, you know, the difference between the three or give this handout out. But we hadn't gotten to the point, well, do you understand why it is that that's the process in the court right now? And so through further questioning, they realized, oh, it's a resource issue. It has to do with how the courts interpret the role of the clerk. There were a myriad of factors that were behind that situation, and then that impacted what we would recommend as a solution. So yes, jump to solutions. And I think the other thing I would sometimes see is jumping to a judgment. I found some notes from one team member, and it says the protection order hearings appear to be placed into the calendar as an afterthought wherever time will allow, low priority. But right next to that, it was real clear that this person really didn't know that. That was their opinion. And so what they needed to do was inquire with the court about how the court calendar was established. So they had come to a conclusion before they had done the full rule analysis, or not analysis in the way we're thinking about it, but the full inquiry.
So going out and searching for more information.
Yes.
Well, how is that calendar constructed?
Exactly.
And what goes into it? And it seems like that first example you mentioned of seeing the forms in on different piles on the counter and sending somebody over to go and find what they needed would be such a good example of how easy it would be to say, well, those clerks, they just don't really care about protection orders and who's doing that. And the discovery then of how that actually comes about seems like it reinforced then this, one of the things that came out of this was putting together a consistent information packet that guides whoever is looking for a protection order to figure out how to do this.
Right.
So then there's gaps. So if a finding is a discovery of something and a conclusion, in this case we've been looking at these findings and conclusions related to attention to access to firearms and knowledge related to firearms. We started playing around with clearly defining gap then as a problematic situation that results from a disparity between what people need and what institutions do. So there's a gap there. I'm looking for safety. I'm saying here a firearm has been used to threaten or harm me. My need is for a system to understand the level of danger I'm in and do something about it. Keep my partner from access to firearms. Take them away, lock them up, whatever that needs means. So a gap then being, is a finding always a gap? Is a gap always a finding? It sounds like a trick riddle, doesn't it?
No, a finding... Well, I don't know if you're asking me or if it's just...
I was kind of throwing it into the ether, but I'll ask it to you, Sue.
Yeah, I would Oh, a finding is not always a gap. That's why I came up with that other statement of many findings might become a gap, and sometimes, no, the findings are kind of the basis for your gap.
And in some cases, we might be finding or discovering, here are examples where someone's needs really were met.
Yeah.
That's going to be instructive for figuring out how do we make that possible in a much more broadly. Seeing as how we do have this method that is focusing on the disparity, the gap, the problem between what people need and what institutions provide.
Mm-hmm.
Let's check in for questions, comments, of course. Again, echoing Marin's earlier encouragement, share your observations about what this has been like on your end. Do we have anything in the email or the phone queue?
At this time, if you have a question, all you need to do is press the number 1 on your phone. Give just a few moments.
And I'll, of course, extend that to Marin and Lucy, too, who have much experience in working through different kinds of institutional analysis and safety audits and bringing it all together.
I do have a question, but let's hear from Carrie to see if anybody beeped in.
We have no questions in the queue at this
time. So, Sue, this question is for you because you've done so many audits, but also Jane, because you've worked with so many communities to help them through the process of doing an audit. Have you ever done one, Sue, where you didn't write a report? And because I know that's been a question out there sometimes that, you know, the report writing can become so resource intensive and so heavy, and then people worry about publicizing it and, you know, those sorts of things. There's been some considerations to not write reports. But speak to that, if you would.
Oh, yeah, and I think we were going to talk about that, too, in a bit, but no.
Oh, okay. All right, good.
No, this would be a good spot, I think, to launch into that.
It's
a good question, Maren.
We have always chosen to write a report as part of our audit process, and we have made that very clear up front to the audited agencies, so they knew from the very beginning that was the plan. So if you're going to do a report, clearly that needs to be an understanding because the report is public. I would agree it's very resource intensive. At the same time, I think it's the writing of the report that really, really solidifies what the work that's been done from the audit team. And in some ways, as lengthy as it may be, I think it gives a great deal of credibility to the process because of how it articulates what you've done and what you found, and that these just aren't willy-nilly gap statements that you've come up with because this particular team, you know, happens to have a particular passion for certain issues.
And I would add too, in looking at your reports, and as Jane mentioned earlier, the usefulness of this to-do list, really, that the report can create for supporting implementation of the recommendations, and how you've used those lists in your committee work, in your commission work. I mean, it's obviously been very powerful. But Jane, have you worked with communities who've opted to not do a report? Or have done something very scaled back, or?
Well, this is a wonderful question, and I would wholeheartedly agree that it is something that seems to be oftentimes a real challenge. And I think one thing to think about is a report is really some kind of account of what has been learned that can be used to inform others of what's been learned and to guide implementation and change. So if there isn't some kind of account of the work of the safety audit or the community assessment, however you've described it, there's a bit of like, should we have bothered in the first place? Because the idea is to look at practice, identify where needs are being met and not met, find those gaps, and then recommend ways of change. So now, what form or format can that summing up and that account take? It can be the narrative with supporting examples and related material, which is similar to what we've been talking about here. So this example that Sue has been describing, and the writing and the reports that Whatcom County has used. So there's that narrative. It follows a structure that's reflected when you have a chance to look at handout number 4 in the packet. That's a template that we can provide in a Word document that organizes this kind of narrative report and walks it through a clear articulation of, here's the gap. How is it a problem? How do we know it's a problem? What contributes to this? What recommendations do we have for change? So that's one kind of report, and it can fill that need to really bring it together in a way that can be used then for ongoing work and change. Another format could be a community forum with a summary and some handouts, maybe sort of the bullet point approach, maybe some slides to go with it. Another format could be something that called a change chart. And those who are on the call who have been to one of our institutes have seen examples of that, and we can provide that as well, which kind of lays out, you think across the top of laying out all the steps that are involved in processing a case. So, for instance, a change chart for a protection order, safety and accountability audit might lay out, first step is contact with the clerk's office or secure the forms. Well, where would you find those? Different points you find those. Fill them out, file them, that initial hearing for a temporary order. So you lay out the steps across the top, and then along the side, well, what kind of changes are we recommending? What kind of change in law, change in a rule or a policy, change in a form or a process, training, kind of laying out those 8 audit trails or 8 ways in which work is organized. That's one approach. It could be a format, could be a manual or handbook. On the Praxis website is the St. Louis County Deputy's Handbook, which really came out of a process of a safety and accountability audit. In some ways, the blueprint for safety is a kind of mega example of the report ultimately being this kind of handbook or guide for policy and practice change. It could be a board game. I remember reading about some folks in Canada who used this institutional analysis approach to look at community response around experiences of people with disabilities, and they ended up creating a board game. Now, all of those are different formats. If you did a narrative, such as we've been talking about, and you'll see this with the Whatcom County reports on their website, they also do a little summary, kind of a findings at a glance version, so that there's always that kind of little shorter version, the longer version. But in the end, you have to do the analysis to get to any of those formats. It's so intertwined, and
it
Jane?
Hello?
Uh-oh.
We lost Jane. Oh, dear.
Mid-thought.
Uh-oh.
Lucy and Sue, I'll work in the background to find her if you don't mind carrying on.
Well, she will talk about all these different ways that groups do this, and going back to Maren's question of the intensity of it, and it seems to me that you're really capturing this, documenting what you've done too, and that there is some value in that 10 years later for groups trying to kind of figure out where this came from and why they're doing it, and the implementation phase. Are there other comments you'd have about that, Sue?
Well, the one other thing I was going to mention, the on this last audit report, it's a long read, and I know that it was read real thoroughly by one of our judges. He was quite interested in it, and court administrator, and it took them time to get to it. But the court administrator had an interesting comment to me, and I realized why the evidence was so important. He was looking at the recommendations, and he said to me, well, I want to know what the example was that this recommendation is related to, because he wanted to see what it was that we had observed or, maybe been text analysis that led to that recommendation, because that would help him understand maybe what it was that needed to happen. So, that gave me some insight into why it was worth the effort to document all those findings.
And really giving the reader the context.
Sorry about that.
All right.
So, I jinxed it by saying that might happen, didn't I?
So Sue was just talking about how important the context of the report is when then there's someone who's thinking about making these changes and actually implementing these recommendations, who may or may not have been on that team, but really helping them understand why and where it came from and giving them some of that framework for making those changes.
Right. I think that's such an important observation there. So it is easy to kind of really get caught up in that whole report conundrum. So part of it's probably kind of thinking about it at the front end, right? Oh, have I been cut off again?
No, you're here.
No.
Oh, I'm so paranoid now about my phone system. And you had mentioned this, Sue, that being real clear up front, this
yeah.
is the approach we're going to take, and it's going to be yeah. out there.
Yep, that's right.
This is, I think, kind of reinforces something. Last night I was kind of trolling around the Praxis website for the training recordings because I was looking for something. And down at the very end of that web page is a series from September of 2007. About planning and conducting a safety and accountability audit. And I would really encourage everyone to go and listen to the one on articulating your findings with Ellen Pence. And we were talking about some of these same things, similar kinds of questions. And Ellen started by saying she just had two rules. Now, she actually never exactly got to the two rules, but we eventually got to three rules. So I thought this would be a good way to kind of wrap up a bit on our conversation today. But the first rule was that the most important person to write to is the person who can change it.
Yeah.
And it sounds like you were maybe talking about that as I was fiddling with the phone.
Yeah.
And therefore needing this clarity about here's what we saw, and here are concrete examples of it.
Yeah.
And then the other two rules, and I'll check these out with you, Sue, as well, since you have so much experience doing this, turned out to be one was to kind of do this, what we call debriefing, this talking about what we're learning, frequently and often, and take good notes.
Does she mean talking frequently and often with the auditation?
With your team, yeah.
With your, oh, yes.
Yeah,
yes.
With your team.
Yes, and take good notes. Oh, yes. I absolutely agree.
Because without that documentation, you're kind of stuck, frankly.
Yeah. And I think the talking frequently and often, you know, what you might think you're noticing at the beginning, it may shift over time and change over time. You know, it gets nuanced. So that's that thing about not locking in right away in the beginning. But I think the more you keep talking about it, the more, I don't know, hopefully honest and clear you will be about what you're really seeing there.
And we have this example, which is in handout one, of a kind of day-long analysis session, this sort of, again, in our jargon that has emerged, the final debriefing. But that kind of process really needs to happen all along the way. And as you said, things shift and change, and eventually you do need to stop.
Yeah.
And kind of bring it all together and be able to say, okay, you know, at this point in time, here's what we've learned about this. But having a mechanism and an organization to have each time everybody's getting together on that team saying, here's what we're seeing. And I think you laid this out at kind of way at the front end of our conversation of having a workbook or a way of the team keeping notes, and they would bring that to discussions, and then you would work with it where they're laying out, okay, here's what I did, and here's kind of what I'm finding out here. Here's the insights, the examples. Need to know more about this, and oh, here's maybe a theme, maybe a potential gap that's starting to bubble up. The third rule in that 2007 conversation with Ellen was don't forget or underestimate how to make use of those audit trails. Mm-hmm. Again, those eight ways in which systems organize work. And have you found them to be your friend over the years?
Well, you know, I think they are your friend in reminding your team members that this is part of what we need to ask about. Because I think, you know, earlier when I talked about people jumping to solutions or jumping to judgment, they're doing that when they're not stopping and thinking about, well, how is it that this worker is organized to do this job? And the audit trails give you, you know, seven or eight different ways to ask a question of someone. So, yes, they're your friend. And, yeah.
Well, and kind of coming back to the gap that we were talking about, seeing really concretely there how you and the team and the work that you did was really anchored in looking at that. What's the rule? What's the law? What's the policy? What does the form look like? How does it work? What's the process? How are people linked?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Exactly.
We are kind of getting up close to our last question time, but before we do that, Sue, is there anything else that you'd like to offer as tips or encouragement, whether it's related to communication and team cohesion in this process, or how you document and sum things up? I know there actually it could be a long list of tips, but what's on your mind right now?
what I was thinking of, and I don't know if this is what people are interested in, but a few thoughts that I'd have about the recommendations and how to write them, because you know, when you get to implementation, you're working with recommendations. And so over the years, I've really thought a lot about, are these, of course your recommendations need to reflect what you find in the audit, and they need to relate back to, you know, how you've uncovered this problem and what's produced it. So they have to link in that way. But I know in every audit report, I think the agencies are overwhelmed by the numbers of recommendations. At least that's been my experience. They kind of look at this and they go, oh my goodness, there's 60 recommendations for my police department. And I get asked things like, well, could you prioritize these for us and tell us what you think are the most important ones? Or sometimes they'll say, well, this one is so broad, I don't really understand. What do you mean by this? You say we need to get training on this. Well, okay, offer it then. Or anyway, so, you know, I think about things when I'm writing them. I like to get visionary and philosophical, but I think, are they doable? Are they manageable? Do you want to prioritize them? I don't know. You know, are they, probably don't make them too broad, because then are they really going to be useful? Are they really going to get at what the problem was? When they're cross systems, you know, we've already talked about that issue, knowing that that's maybe going to be a little bit more challenging for implementation. I know there are other things that impact implementation, which may not have to do with how you've written the recommendations, but I think anything in a recommendation that might help institutionalize a change is helpful, because sometimes, you know, I'll see a change is implemented, but it's not really institutionalized. Maybe it's not written down as a particular procedure, so then it doesn't get carried forward as there's a leadership change. So is it quantity or is it quality? You know, which do we care more about? Anyway, those are just some thoughts about recommendations, how they're written, and how that might relate to implementation.
And it seems, too, that it doesn't, it's not a surprise in the sense that when a police chief or a district court administrator finally has this in front of them, it's not like,
right,
oh my God, these people have
right
dropped a sandbag on my head. I didn't know all this was going on. But they've been informed in some ways every step of the way.
Yes, yeah. They don't always know. Well, in our case, each of the agency heads always sees a copy of the report when it's in draft form before it gets released to the public and we have an opportunity to talk about it. So up until that time, they may not know, you know, specifically what's going to be in there, but it's never, when it's finally released to the public, it is not a surprise. They are fully informed about what's going to be in the report.
Okay, well, thank you so much. And do we have a minute for any questions, comments before we wrap up?
Absolutely. So once again, if you have a question, all you need to do is press the number one on your phone. That'll get you into the question queue. We'll give just a few moments.
And as Maren said, we do know a fair number of you are out there, some of you pulling your hair out about bringing this all together. So,
if I can just slip in a question, this is Lucy. I mean,
yeah,
you were talking about these decisions that you were making as you write, Sue, and is that something that you do as a, excuse me, as an activity alone? Is this something that you continually, I mean, is the team meeting and like voting on these things, or is this a solitary activity?
You mean the writing part?
Yeah, you know, when you're deciding how to frame things and making those.
Well, actually, this last report, I asked different members to write the section on how is this a problem for victims, and so.
Oh.
They each, different people had an opportunity to do one for each gap, and then I used what they had and kind of elaborated. How I put the findings together were definitely, that was my work. So most of the writing I did on my own, but really it was using their work, and but it was me organizing it and thinking about how to put it together. But the team did see a draft, two different drafts, so they had a chance to review it when it was, the first draft was done, and changes were then made after that, and they had a chance to review it again. But I would say the writing I'm doing on my own, but they're really all over it, in a sense, if you know what I mean.
Okay, thank you.
Any questions in the queue, Carrie?
There are no questions at this time.
Okay. Well, we are heading up to our closing time, and I want to encourage everyone to take a look at this handout packet. It has a lot of tools and templates that support arriving at the kind of report and recommendation and thinking about structuring that summing up in a way that will support implementation. We'll also be sending out the full copy of the report that pertains to this protection order safety audit, and encourage any of you who are working on trying to sum things up and figure out what is our report going to look like to contact us for some more one-on-one conversations, if that's helpful. And I'll turn things back to Lucy for the final wrap-up and farewell.
Thank you, Jane, and thank you, Sue. I mean, this is just some very powerful, practical information, giving us really good insights, and I thank you for putting together the handout and getting it out so we can kind of follow along and look at how things are broken down. That's really, really helpful. So there are more trainings coming up. Maren, did you want to talk about some of the there's a networking call next week?
Yep, can you hear me? I have two different mute buttons that I do double insurance because my kids just got here. I have a little overlap in the afternoon. So next week we have a networking call, and those are a little less formal, more conversation-driven, on organizing and facilitating team meetings as part of a community assessment process. And we're lucky to have Olga Trujillo as our the person we're going to have a conversation with about doing this. She's consulted on a number of audits, specifically sexual assault audits, that have been very interesting. So we look forward to having that conversation with her next week. And we do have these monthly networking calls. The next one is in September on the 26th, and that's going to be looking at assessing multiple agencies in a community, not just one point of intervention. And you can go on our website to find out the rest of the topics that we're having this year. This actually, today concludes the series of audio conference trainings that we're doing this year on community assessments. We'll regroup and offer another series starting in 2013. And we will be offering a new webinar-ish resource on our domestic violence best practice assessment tools. We concluded a series on that this summer, and we are putting together a new tool that hopefully you can use in your community to provide an orientation to the tools and the use of them to community partners who might be interested in engaging in that process with you. So that should be coming out by the end of the year, but this is sort of wrapping up our busy season of TA and training offerings. But again, anytime, we're always available for individualized assistance. In fact, we're trying to coordinate a phone call with some folks in North Dakota, different communities in South Dakota, rather, that have been conducting audits, and giving them some one-on-one customized assistance with some report writing work. So that's just an example of some one-on-one tailored assistance that we can offer you. So I want to encourage you to contact us anytime for any issue. We're really happy and excited to help folks with implementing this process in their communities. So thanks to our speakers, and thanks to Lucy, our host. Any final wrap-up of anything else?
just going to remind people to look for those handouts that will be coming out and an evaluation form. So, thank you all for joining us, and we'll talk to you hopefully next week on the 22nd for that networking call. Take care.
Thanks, everyone.
Take care.